I'm ready. Go. Where's my ticket for the ship, man?
Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Welcome to the program, my friends, Earth Explorers. X Squared Radio, coming to you live from Western Idaho. Our AccuWeather window forecast, it's about 155 degrees outside, and not a cloud in the sky. The solar wind tonight, 402.1 kilometers per second, and the proton count is up to 12.2. That is up about six times over last week. And in the space news, noctilucent clouds have drifted for the first time as far south as Wyoming. Very strange indeed. These are high-altitude clouds that are illuminated by the sun that is on the other side of the planet, but whose light is able to reach over the pole to the upper atmosphere. Strange that light is bending that far around the globe. I wonder what is driving the magnetic force. Could we be getting ready for a polar shift? Huge geysers on Saturn's moon Enceladus may be fed by a salty sea below its surface, boosting the odds of extraterrestrial life in our own solar system. According to a study released Wednesday, researchers in Europe detected salt particles in the volcanic vapor and ice jets that shoot hundreds of kilometers into space. The strongest evidence to date of a liquid ocean under the moon's icy crust. Since their discovery in 2005, the giant geysers have fueled intense speculation on the presence of a subterranean ocean, and the new discovery goes a long way toward resolving one of the most hotly debated topics in planetary science. Sodium also scatters sunlight efficiently in the orange-yellow range of the spectrum, and is thus easy to detect even in minute quantities. If you want to try it yourself, make up some salt water and get yourself a little wire loop, get it wet, and put it into a flame, and you'll see a pretty yellow flame. In a second study, a team led by Nicholas Schneider of Colorado University likewise looked for salts in Enceladus's plume, this time using spectrographs on Earth-bound telescopes. Guess what they didn't find? Sodium. This means the plumes could come from salty underwater or under a crust formations, but distilling into freshwater vapors, but not through evaporation as happens over Earth's oceans, but rather in pressurized chambers under the moon's surface. I don't know if you know what that means, but fresh water is exactly what we needed to find. And that means that there are freshwater hot springs under the crust of Enceladus. Makes the prospect of life under the crust of the moon above Saturn a distinct possibility. A sluggish jet stream like flow deep inside the sun could be to blame for the delay in increased solar activity that has been stumping astronomers. The jet stream, which is actually a plasma current called a torsional oscillation, has been migrating more slowly than usual through the star's interior, according to a team led by Frank Hill of the National Solar Observatory in Tucson, Arizona. Every 11 years, the sun generates new jet streams near its poles. These streams slowly drift from east to west toward the solar equator over a period of 17 years. Evidence supports those who say we're getting ready for another ice age. Well, it's not clear whether this slower jet stream is a cause or a consequence of the mysterious solar quiet, Hill said. But the fact that we see it a couple of years in advance of the sun's extended quiet makes me think it's a cause. Well, you would think that's logical. But both Gong and SOHO, these are the two satellites that with which we monitor the sun, right now the best instruments that we have for it, have been in operation for only 14 years. That is a cosmic microsecond when you're considering space, for scientists to get comfortable with the type of data being returned. By contrast, sunspots have been tracked as a measure of solar activity for hundreds of years. And this is only the second time sunspots have been slow to arrive on schedule. Solar cycle 24, still largely a no-show, with a couple of technical sunspots, very small, very inactive, not capable of really belching out any solar flares. So we do say that solar cycle 24 has started, but it's nothing dramatic. And on another note, because the second volume of The Arc of Millions of Years in a chapter called The Watchers has an extensive write-up on how it is believed the Nephilim, who may still be here on the planet, are planning a one-world government, a global takeover without war, without violence, the way it's been tried so many times before. This time, what's happening is economic means are being used. And in that chapter, we very carefully map out exactly how that is going to happen. Well, today in the news, U.S. stocks fell as the highest American savings rate in 15 years spurred concern that spending will slow, while falling oil drove down energy producers. The dollar dropped after China's central bank reiterated a call for a worldwide currency. The dollar slumped 0.7% against six trading partners as China sought to replace it as the global reserve currency. The Swiss franc declined against the euro and dollar this week as foreign exchange analysts said the central bank sold its currency three times to support the economy. The greenback fell against most of its major counterparts after the People's Bank of China said yesterday the International Monetary Fund should manage more of members' foreign exchange reserves. Now, here's the important part. The dollar's status as a reserve currency is being questioned. Pay no attention to that train behind me. That's what happens when you build biodiesel plants. They're next to railroad tracks, and I'm in the office of the biodiesel plant, so you're going to hear a train about every hour. Anyway, the dollar's status as a reserve currency is being questioned, said Benedict Germanier, a foreign exchange strategist in Stamford, Connecticut, at UBS AG, the second largest currency trader. There are reasons to sell the dollar. We have been telling you for months now to make sure you put together some kind of emergency preparedness plan. Perhaps this news will help you decide to put aside a few dollars and follow through with our advice. By the way, the first part of that article did say that personal savings is at the highest rate in 15 years. That means that some of you are finally getting the message that the way to freedom is to get rid of your debt. All right, no commercials this first hour. I do want to let you know the phone lines will be open all night. You can call us toll-free anywhere, U.S. and Canada, 888-228-4494. And if you've got free nights and weekends on that cell phone or you just want to make a quick comment and don't mind the fee, you can reach us by getting to a cell phone tower anywhere in the country at 530-776-5154. Our guest tonight is the owner of Zero Point Research in Santa Monica, California. He is a former technology developer for Lockheed Skunk Works. Left there, naturally went into the special effects business for Hollywood, bringing us such amazing films. Just an unbelievable genesis and evolution in the quality of special effects in movies these days. And then one night, as having an epiphany by speaking to a Egyptian mythologist who we know, got an epiphany for a new piece of technology called the Life Stream Generator. We've had him on the program a couple of times talking about that. We are very glad to have him back on the program tonight. Welcome, John Riley, to the program.
Thank you very much, Brooks. It's great to be here.
So we're getting ready next week to conduct a human consciousness experiment at the eSETI Earth Transformation Conference. And I thought it would be an excellent time to bring you on and let you talk about this transition that human consciousness seems to be making on the Earth and how technology might play a role in enhancing that.
That's perfect. Actually, it's getting very exciting when we look at when mankind actually brings forth what we call technologies, and especially when they're connected to the understanding of energy and what we learned, you know, especially last year. It was real exciting for us, you know, when we spent, you know, time, a few days out there in the conference, where we got to see what happened when we started bringing the collective consciousness together and accompanied with the technology. So I know when you and I, you know, have our conversations, we get into what we call the stream of consciousness, and we start, you know, answering, either finishing each other's sentences, you know, from which is kind of exciting, you know, because that really makes a, you know, an amazing conversation. But then when we start realizing, the clearer we become, or we come higher in our consciousness or our wakefulness of realization, and then we start bringing higher level technology fields or energy fields into that play, we start to see something amazing that happens within our reality. So taking it to the next level, preparing for, you know, constantly unfolding research, moving higher, you know, I mean, we get to just see amazing things that our cameras are picking up now, and now our own eyes.
Well, maybe because I would say the vast majority of the millions of people who hear this broadcast each week weren't at the eSETI conference last year up in Trout Lake, Washington at James Gilliland's place, and they weren't privy to the absolutely stunning photographic results that we got during this experiment. Perhaps you could explain what it is you set up and how we conducted that.
Yes, absolutely. Well, one of the exciting things is that in my research, I started to realize that, and you mentioned this too, is how the human body and the human consciousness is so important in the regards to our connection to technology, and especially when we work with particular radiant energy fields or unification fields that I work with constantly. So when we got out into the fields, we started bringing the collective consciousness together. We literally started getting groups, about 35 people, I think the first night. And instinctively, I realized that we would follow the golden ratio. We would do like a Fibonacci spiral. And we started having everyone hold hands while we turned on one particular level of technology that I brought out there, which creates a 3.3 million volt radiant energy field. Now, to understand that, what was great within these 35 people who were out there never experienced this before except for a handful of us. So every time we started holding hands, every time we would create a bigger connection, the energy field got larger. And it got larger every time someone would put their hand on it. And I wouldn't even be interacting with the technology, but something about the human element was at play, and we got to see something amazing, because what we did at that point in time, once we all connected, then we started, I was being at the front of it, connected to the technology, we started to interact, and people felt the surges of energy going through the group. And it literally, we had the ability to pulse it like a wave through it, and we were connected to nothing. This is a unified field of energy that we can emit once again, because we're remembering how to do this. And what was great is we had people on the outside of the circle taking pictures. and we got to see amazing things that we never saw before documented. And, it, you know, when we can realize that there were two, three people photographing the same things, then we can literally throw out that it was an anomaly in the camera at the point of time that we photographed.
Just getting exciting
on that aspect.
Just to kind of add a little bit of detail, this experiment took place well after dark. And this Fibonacci spiral of, perhaps close to 50 people, was carefully laid out and then sort of magnetically connected to this technology which John set up. And I'm going to say it was a little bit like a magnetic crack the whip, because this energy pulsed back and forth up and down this spiral. But that wasn't the important part. There was an amazing feeling of euphoria that just enveloped this group. And I'm not going to say they were the most conscious people of the 300 or 400 people that were there that night, but I will say this was an unorganized event, and so those people who just sort of naturally felt gravitated to this experiment came over. And as it turned out, what occurred above us, what we captured on film above this group, I have never seen before. And I've shown the photograph to people, and they said, what in the world was going on there? And it looked like an interface between two dimensions. That's what was going on, at least in my opinion. How about you?
Well, yeah, we're both on the same page as that, because one of the things that when I started to research the photos, now what was great about that is that I took photos myself. I had a camera, and then at the right time I would take the camera, I'd put it over my head, and I'd start shooting photos, because I was literally right at the start of the circle, right next to the technology. Now, when we started to see the photos on the outside, what was really interesting is because we sustained such a large field, what we saw is what we call orb energies. Now, what happened is that in this level of communication, they literally showed us something that we haven't seen before. And when we started that evening, we started seeing the orb energies every time we were going into a higher frequency within ourselves. The orb started to appear, and we started seeing massive orb photos. But then we got the technology involved, and what they literally did is that there was a picture, if I recall, that James Gilliland took, and he was actually standing outside, and he shot it, and the people were in the circle, and right above the heads of everyone were mass orbs that were following the spiral. Now, when I saw that, I had to take a step back, because they literally separated themselves. For the first time, they were above us, and they were massed above us. But what was really unique is the further I looked in that photo, there were orbs that were literally, they're spheres, but they were cut in half. Now, when I looked at that, I studied that. I said, wait a minute, they're like entering through a dimensional realm.
Exactly.
And because we've never seen half orbs before, you know, like a half moon. You know, we were seeing these in the photos, and there were hundreds of them like that, but only at a particular band where they were entering. Some were already in, and some were coming through during the photograph. So this was amazing that we were able to take it to the next level. And I know, if you recall, we had Dr. Michal Ledwith out there, who has been doing incredible orb research, and he was out there the second night, so we got to take it to another level. But yes, each night the photographs, you know, definitely were literally blowing us away, because it was just a new discovery, new realizations.
Well, I'm not going to say that it was planned, because so often when we're conducting experiments, scientific experiments, and we're introducing an interface between technology and the human element, very often the unexpected happens. And when it's recorded, even if it's recorded real time, we have a tendency to go back and look at the data as we're trying to treat the data and trying to understand how it applies to the hypothesis we're working on, but also brainstorming on what other hypotheses could be developed from that data. This is where, you know, John and I realized we have to do this again. And we've got to do it more focused, and we got to do it with purpose, and we got to realize what the heck is going on here, because something And I'm going to call it extra-dimensional because it was by no means three-dimensional, but we were... I'm going to say we definitely picked it up with digital photography, but we were picking up the orbs with our naked eyes when the flash would go off. We weren't looking in the camera. We were looking up into the night when the flash went off, and we could see the fluorescence of the orbs above us with our naked eyes. Now, that I've never experienced before, and that's what led me to believe that perhaps the technology, which is synchronized to a human frequency, it is not an AC frequency. You could explain a lot more about the technology than I can or wish to, but there was some kind of enabling of the human connection to this energy. And I've seen an orb or two, or a dozen or two dozen. But, John, we're talking about millions of orbs that were in this photograph. It was like a tornado of orbs.
Yes. Yeah, the tornado, that was mind-blowing, is actually when I took the picture above my head, I felt the massing of the energies. I looked up, and I wasn't able to see it with my eyes, but I was, you know, instinctively guided to take the photograph, and I saw exactly what you said with my own eyes. And then when I took the camera and transferred the photo, I took it, and I have a special filter that I shift the spectrum. And all of a sudden when I did that, that's when we saw the millions of orbs literally funneling in. And you can actually see the curvature of the funnel, you know, and it literally coming into a point. But it was just, I'd never seen anything like that before. So, yes, and it really opened my eyes in the research that something amazing is happening, and we're opening up, and this is the true connection to consciousness. And I think this is the reason why we're having this interview today, is talking about the new paradigms in consciousness that's happening. It's about us breaking the programs, you know, that we've been in, you know, since we've actually entered this earth, you know, in this life cycle. And when we realize that, what we're capable of, we start letting go, and we start letting go of dogmas, you know, and old programs that came in at any time in our lives. So when we realize what we're truly capable of and the level that we can achieve, then we get, now we're at this point of this threshold, is that we're bringing the human, and we're also bringing the technology together to amplify what we are. And that's exactly what I work with my research, is amplification tools for the human aspect.
Well, you know, there's a lot of research going on in this area, but I've got to say, although it seems to be institutional and it definitely seems to be affiliated, that is to say, affiliated with the ordinary scientific medical community in this, I don't think they really understand what's going on. I know psychological researchers call it transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS, and the basic premise of this is that the brain operates using electric signals, and it's possible to alter the way the brain works by altering the electrical environment. And in old days, they used to call this electroshock therapy, but it's not that at all now. In fact, the technology that I've seen work at John's clinic isn't AC at all. It's a DC magnetic field, and it has such a profound and immediate effect as to rival the very best drugs that you could think of for Parkinson's disease. Now, I know you don't want to make any medical claims, but I'm just saying, as an outside scientist looking in, I've seen the before and after of this technology interacting with the human transducer, which we call the human being, or the biological transducer, which we call the human body. It is having, because you have tuned this rotating magnetic field to the resonant frequency of the biological transducer, you are really getting profound effects, not only in the way the brain operates, but in the way the physical body lenses the consciousness. And that is what's really opening up here, isn't it, John?
Oh, absolutely. When we look at, one of the wonderful things that we always observe, and you mentioned it, is how good people feel. And we see people almost become euphoric in this energy. But one of the things that I like to do when we get the groups like that is to look at them before, and then integrating the energy for a while, and then I like to walk up to people. You know, they have like bright smiles on their face, even when this energy is surging through them. No one frowns and runs away. They all become part of it, and they're all laughing, huge smiles on their face. So I walk up to those people. I go, can you do me a favor? And they go, yeah. I said, can you think of a negative thought for me? And they're like, no, I can't. I said, can you try really hard? And they're like, I don't want to. And I go, isn't that interesting, is that your mind cannot bring a negative thought forward in this energy? So when we realize that, it's bringing us into the neutral state of what we are, because we're capable of moving into a positive energy field, we're capable of moving into a negative energy field at any time. But when we get to that neutral, that zero-point aspect, this is where it becomes really amazing. We get to watch the homeostasis within the mind, the reduction of stress on the physical body, nearly eliminate itself in that time when we're in the energy field. So this is very exciting. When you see this with a handful of people, then you start seeing it with hundreds, and then you start getting to the point of seeing the same result with thousands, it really, you know, coerces you to continue your research into higher levels of understanding. So this has been an amazing journey.
Yeah, and you know, lest Earth explorers, you should equate this with Soma, a la Soylent Green. It is not. It is a way of neutralizing the negative energy that's around you. And believe it or not, your cognizance, your awareness of the energies around you and the energies in other people is greatly enhanced. And in such a positive way that you are able to empower your consciousness, not subdue it. At least that's the feeling that I got. It's greatly invigorating.
Absolutely. Well, that's one of the wonderful things is that we realize is that we get, you know, of course, when we're in the fields or when we're at my center, we get all types of people. We get, you know, I love the skeptics. They're the best because we shift their consciousness, you know, right after. You know, they'll walk out or experiencing things that they never experienced before or thought possible. And this is what we're understanding about the new paradigms, because we can sit here and you and I, Brooks, we know very well there's plenty of theories out there of what's happening. But when we have the ability to literally bring it into the third dimensional aspect and bring proof forward, then it's a little hard to deduce it or to deny it when you experience this. Now, I mean this on many levels, is that when we see the unification within the mass consciousness, you know, or the groups that are part of this, but then when we obscurely take like a crystal, and I think we did this last year. We took a large crystal wafer, a natural quartz crystal that I brought out there, and I had people hold it and walk up to the technology. Now, there's no wires involved in this at all, but as soon as they get within 3 feet of the technology, it starts to sing. It starts to resonate at a high amplification, and it literally puts out these incredible tones. And almost everyone who does that, they can't believe this. They go, how's this happening? And I go, exactly. I don't tell them how it's happening. I want them to tell me. So I just smile, and they hand it to someone else, and you know, it sings for them. So we start doing this resonance research, and every time, you know, we learn a little bit more because we explore further. We start, you know, working with larger, you know, resonance structures, and then we start understanding, and then it literally flings us back into history. And this is very interesting when I go there in my talks, because they say we're literally remembering again, you know, and when you and I, you know, had the wonderful trip to Egypt last year. You know, we were seeing the writings on the wall. We were seeing the technologies that existed back then.
That was very amazing. I think we were at Edfu and we were at Abydos.
Yes.
And on the wall, in relief, perfectly preserved, is the technology. Now, it's an ancient version of it. And it looks like they were, you know, accomplishing the generation of the magnetic field with oxen turning a giant golden table. But they were generating it just like that.
Absolutely. You know, and of course, you know, current, we're changing, you know, the way that we hold in our arrogance, you know, or in the ego aspect, because, you know, there was many people stating that we're at the highest of our technology. You know, at this time, there was never technologies or capabilities of harnessing energy in the past. But then they stumbled across what was called the Baghdad battery, you know, back in the late 70s. That was dated to be over 2,300 years old. You know, that it works almost exactly the same way as we, you know, create batteries now.
Right.
You know, but then what was great is that when we looked at the device on the wall, and our mutual friend, you know, had it 3D illustrated, and that was the best part, is that when we looked at that, and I said, well, this is great, but you guys are still thinking two-dimensionally. And this is what, you know, when we look at Egyptology and the information that they share at this point in time, because it's based on man's interpretation of what they perceive. And the writing on the wall could be there, you know, for thousands of years. And then all of a sudden, someone with a higher level of consciousness or awareness will go, hey, well, what's going on here? And then all of a sudden, the people that were educated, they go, well, you know, I've never saw that before. You know,
yeah,
they
were thinking like Klingons because they only made an XY perspective. But once you stepped up and said, why don't you tilt it a little bit in the Z perspective and see what you see? And that's when the technology revealed itself.
It changed everything, exactly, because they left us wonderful two-dimensional references. Now we have to consciously bring it into a 3D, third-dimensional, you know, exactly what you said, or even further than that. You know, but let's start with 3D. You know, we have to take two-dimensional images and make them 3D, but we have to see them in 3D. And that was exactly, you know, like when we saw the rectangular platform with the man and the ox. And the man was on the outside of the ox. And I said, well, what would they do up there? Just stand there. Yeah, it's a rectangular tablet, a platform. They can't do anything. I said, but if we make that a circle, a round disc, now what would the man be doing? And everyone looked at me, and I said, he'd be walking the ox around. And the ox, I'm pretty sure, is attached to the inner shaft that would be turning that shaft. And when we turn... when we create a rotation like that, that's exactly how we produce electricity to this day.
Yeah.
You know, we have coil windings and we have magnets, and we move either way. You know, we can, you know, see it from Faraday's law of induction, or we can just see it from, like, literally induction motors. It happens through a rotational field movement, and that's it. That's all. And then this phenomenon happens. So they were definitely doing it, and they were lucky because they had gold and palladium, you know, precious, you know, high conductive materials, not copper. You know, they were using the purest of materials. You know, for us, it's very expensive to do that. You know, we don't make gold windings in our motors because of the cost. If we did, they'd be incredibly efficient.
Oh, yeah. I used to race slot cars when I was very young, and the costly motors were the ones with the gold windings. But
exactly.
Once you had the gold windings, nobody could beat you.
Exactly. Tremendous amount of energy produced.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the epiphany, because when you saw this, I'm going to call it a perspective view, electronically, they took the flat view that the Egyptians had drawn on the wall, and they'd done a 2D perspective, just tilted it right to left so you could see a little bit more of the depth and detail of what was going on there. How did this hit you? What happened to you at that point in your life? You were... you know, a high technology electronics engineer working for Lockheed, and you're shown this amazing two dimensional. Actually, you see it in a video that you're remixing, and what happened to you?
Well, what happened to me? I guess it was about 30 years of preparation to prepare for the time that I walked into the temples. And the reason why I mention that is because I worked with some of the best illustrators in the industry, working with Steven Spielberg, Robert Zemeckis, James Cameron, you know, working on A films, you know, and literally, you know, one of my first films was like with Robert Zemeckis on Back to the Future 2, and he was adamant about bringing 30 years of future technology forward, and he was challenging everyone in the industry, and he said, this is what I want, and the illustrators created his vision, but it was ahead of technology. So literally, the best effects people said, we can't do that. This is the best we can do. And the director said, that's not good enough. There's got to be a way to do this. So they found me in my little hole, you know, and I just stepped into the industry right out of Lockheed, you know, debrief from Skunk Works. I go right in and looking at the latest developmental technologies. And they found me, and I, with confidence, they said, yeah, we can do that. And they said, are you sure? Because everyone says it can't be done. And I go, yeah, I'm pretty sure we can do this. Now, what happened in that moment is when we created it, we brought in the three-dimensional aspect, is that I realized that, you know, consciously, you know, there's a few of us that have the ability to see it and to bring it forth. You know, it might be difficult or it might be effortless. But then, now this jumps me to Egypt. And I made sure that in my life I did not study Egyptology, you know, and become an Egyptologist. Something about guidance said, see the writings on the wall for what they really mean. So I was not pre-programmed to look at a symbol and say, oh, that means that. So when I saw the device, I had a pretty good idea of what it meant. So, yeah, it was an incredible awakening, because some of the research that I did and then you experienced, and one of them that we talked about, what we call the Gateway Project, you know, where we had dual fields. And we had a singularity, but then we started bringing dual elements into this aspect. And then everything changed in our understanding of energy. And we started experiencing things, you know, on a very unusual level. And remember the time dilation that happened with all the clock references and the fluidic energy? You know, all these things.
That was a strange thing.
Yes, very unusual. Again, first time experiences of this, but it felt right to us to continue to pursue. We always have an incredible level of safety, and we knew we were literally going to the next step of awareness and what we're capable of. So this, when we look at how that technology worked, using an incredible collective of gold, you know, like when we understand that the Ark of the Covenant, you know, was created out of gold, pure gold. And when we understand, when we get, when we create a box of pure gold, it becomes a super capacitor. It harnesses so much energy just on its own, electrostatically. You know, just because of the magnetosphere of the planet, it becomes an accumulator. And it discharges at will.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't have a fixed dielectric. It depends on a lot of variables.
No motor needed. We can store energy in a bell jar, and you can't see it, but it's in there. You
That's
know?
Right.
You tell someone to put those two wires together, and what happens? Energy shoots off. You know, you have a huge arc. So when we understand that, when we understand just like, you know, the relations, you know, a lot of people like to call it the arc, you know, and relate it to the arc, but we understand the same principles and what it's capable of. But then the human connection changes everything. And when we look at that, well, if we go to the Ark of the Covenant and when we hear the stories, is that, you know, sometimes it laid waste, you know, it destroyed the enemy before you. Now it's really interesting. Now the carriers, you know, why were they able to carry it? Well, they came from the temples. They were prepared for this. They were in the energy. They became in harmony with it. So thus, they can walk up just like I do and interact with the technology, and I do it effortlessly. Most people jump like crazy because they're not in balance. Some people get, you know, literally you saw huge energies jump off of people, and they react to it. But it's really interesting. Some of us walk into harmony. We walk right into the field, and it's like us. We're a part of it.
I recall images of Tesla walking around his huge static electricity machines and even inviting his friend Mark Twain at the World's Fair to come up and stand in the energy. And, of course, Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain, was not ready for it and unfortunately soiled his pants while he was in the field. But all in good fun. But it is interesting that once you begin working inside this field, and John is mentioning this gateway that really accidentally got created. It just felt right. We just took two of the technologies and put them a certain distance apart. We measured it very carefully. We set up the safety parameters. We started the video, and on the video when we turned the technology on was right on the film was a vesica piscis opened up right there on the film. And we walked repeatedly through it, and it changed our watches. By the way, that watch died about a day after that. And the clock on the wall, and it was very interesting how the shift in timing occurred. We still don't know exactly what was created that day, but I can tell you both of us have had, well, the three of us that were there that day have all had amazing flow of creativity, all of which has been successful in one way or another, either monetarily or in opening up consciousness. And one of the things, and I want to talk about this a lot more in the next hour, you're talking about the shifting of the paradigm. Can you explain to the listeners, first of all, what a paradigm is and why it might be shifting and why it needs to be shifted?
Absolutely. Well, to use a simple analogy of paradigms, is that usually there's consortiums. You know, when a technology is created, and we can use like DVD players, you know, for an example. When DVD, the digital versatile disc came out, it was introduced to the Consumer Electronics Show. And we all oohed and aahed about it because it was a breakthrough in data storage. And when they introduced it, they had single layer, dual layer, multiple layer. And they knew all this right away. They knew what it was capable of. And what happened is that they looked at it and they said, well, we can store like almost 5 gigs on a single layer. We could do like twice as much on a dual layer. We could do 35 gigs on a single layer, all on one disk. Now, we all stared at it for years because the manufacturers had to agree to the standard to release it to the consumers. Now, what happened is that it's about paradigms. So what do? Is that when you create a paradigm, you introduce something, and then you slowly shift it. And it's usually the estimation of a paradigm shift to accept the highest level technology is 7 to 10 years. That's a standard for some reason when we look at technologies. So we implemented the single layer red laser readable DVD players, and that's what everyone had. And then dual layers were like, it was already, the dual layer was embedded in there. So we had, you know, we had single layer discs, then we went to the dual layer discs. You didn't have to turn the disc over anymore. And then Blu-ray was introduced just a couple years ago. Now Blu-ray allowed us to have multiple layers and watch incredible high definition and have room to spare. You can put so much data on a single disc now. So when we understand that paradigm, that happened over a 7 to 10 year span to change the technologies, to adjust to them. I don't know if that works for most people, if they can relate to that.
Well,
there's always,
you know,
a paradigm structure that's implemented with technologies or just actually in our consciousness. You know, what we're told and we're educated to a certain level, then we go to a next, then we go to a next.
We often talk about the PlayStation saga, where, you know, PlayStation 2 was really already ready for launch when PlayStation 1 was launched. And people often said, gee, why didn't they just jump, you know, to PlayStation 2? Why did they go through the whole PlayStation 1 thing? And it's all about the paradigm of money. Why would you launch your best technology when you can launch the second best and make a couple of billion dollars and then launch the best, which was then the second best because PlayStation 3 was already on the board? And so you build this, you know, huge mega empire of Sony based on the need for people to have better and better graphics and faster speeds for games. But that same driver is being exceeded by human consciousness. The human consciousness right now is screaming for alternative energy. It is screaming for technology that doesn't pollute. And it's an unbelievable crescendo of screams for people that know in their heart of hearts, in their mind of minds, that there's even free energy available out there. We don't know how to bring it forward yet. It's, like I said, PlayStation 3 back there on the board somewhere. But our consciousness is well ahead of the curve. And we want to know what's going on. That's why X Squared Radio is so popular, because people really want to hear what's really going on behind the scenes.
Absolutely. You know, one of the relations, did you own, I'll ask you a question, did you own Star Wars on VHS?
Yes, I did. I have
okay.
All of them.
Now, when DVDs came out, did you get it on DVD?
Yes, I did.
Okay, and now when you get your Blu-ray player, will you get it on a Blu-ray disc?
No, I'm drawing the line there, John.
Okay, that's the paradigm right there, is that you had the film, and you're going to change it three times.
Yep.
Okay, and now when we look at what's associated to that, yes, there is finances. It's brilliant. There's consortiums that do this. They sit there in think tanks. and they go, you know, when we implement this technology, and then 10 years later, 15 years later, we implement this technology, we'll get the people, the consumers, to buy this film three times.
That's right.
And literally, like, I just had a yard sale yesterday, and I took all my DVDs. I mean, I had thousands of dollars. I had Criterion collections, you know, deluxe editions, and I had boxes of DVDs that I put out, and I sold them all for a dollar.
Wow.
You know, yeah, I made the most money on my DVD collection. But then I looked, I said, you know, back in the day, I spent thousands on this collection.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but then I'm moving to, I have a Blu-ray player now. So what am I doing? I'm moving to the next. I'm shifting my paradigm.
It's so wild, though, when you watch a movie that is actually made for Blu-ray, how much detail is there. It's not
absolutely
like looking at a movie. It's like looking out of a window.
Absolutely. And we were looking at high-definition cameras 15 years ago.
Right.
That technology was there, but now this is like one of the things is that we can do this, you know, all night and talk about the paradigm shifts. And there's reasons. You know, a lot of people might get upset when they realize, oh, my gosh, yeah, when I look back, you know, I did. I bought this movie three times, maybe four times if I had Laserdisc. And now I've thrown all those old mediums away.
What choice did you have? I mean, would you say when it came out of I'm not going to buy it on VHS. I know there'll be better technology someday. I'll buy it then.
You can't do that. Absolutely. Now that's a consciousness person that will do that. Or you could do it. You could be a spendthrift. You know, you could be really, like, you know, frugal with your money. Or you could be conscious, realizing that there are paradigms in play. And I go, oh, no, in about 5 years, there's another technology. That's when I'll buy it. And then I can bank on it. And you'll say the same thing 5 years from now. Again, I'll get the latest technology in 5 years.
Mm.
You know, we do this all the time, but we have to be conscious about the paradigms.
And so when people ask you, why are you putting that 223 phase plug in your garage? Oh, that's for where I'm going to park my electric car.
Right.
But electric cars aren't out yet. I know, but I'm just getting ready. That's the paradigm shift. So what's happening in the paradigm shift in human consciousness?
Well, the wonderful thing that's happening in the now, whether it's hitting the actual public mainstream is like one thing, but when we research and we realize that we're going into this new level. Now, one of the things that I can definitely, you know, absolutely know in my research is that we are at a point on this planet that has never been. You know, but when we're looking at the consciousness aspect that we are journeying through, accompanied with the technologies that we have in place and how they mimic us. You know, they come from us, so they have to mimic, they mimic what we're capable of. And they're an amplification of what we are. They're tools for what we already are. The when we look at what's changing in this is new aspects or realizations or comprehensions that have never been comprehensible before. Now, when it happens to you, it changes everything because you'll stand there and you'll have this moment where you'll look at that and you'll say, I never thought that was possible. And that'll let you know something great is happening on this planet.
Well, I remember talking to Jim Bell at Caltech. He's the guy that runs the Mars rover program now. And I said, Jim, you know, what's really the drawback with these three rovers that are running around on Mars? He said, well, it's the communications. You know, we have to send a message to the Marsis satellite, which is going around Mars, and it captures the message in its large antenna, waits till it gets around the planet to the rover, broadcasts the message down to the rover follows the instructions, sends back the feedback to the Marsis satellite, which then gets around on the side of Earth, broadcasts it back to Earth. So it takes about, you know, 18 minutes for each communication back and forth. He said, you think dial-up modems are slow? So I said, well, Jim, why don't you put beryllium ion modems on those things, and then you can communicate with it instantaneously? And he said, what's a beryllium ion modem? I said, well, you know, beryllium is an entanglable ion, and you can put its sister particle here on Earth and the one in the rover on Mars, and then you can simply just change the state of the ion here, and the ion will change state instantaneously on Mars, and thus you'll be able to communicate directly with the rover real time. And he said, I've never heard of a beryllium ion modem. I said, well, Jim, that's because they haven't been invented yet. But they do work, I'm telling you.
Yeah, it's so beautiful, isn't it?
that's where we're at.
Yes. Well, we're so there, and you're so right in the aspect. And we can literally go back in time. And when we look at that, the conscious influence, where we're at this point is when television was discovered. And now when we look at what's happening in the human consciousness and the stories, the visionaries that are putting this information into the mass consciousness. And this is the only time that we realize where this was capable of, where we can broadcast a signal around the world and the collective will be watching it. Now, one of the ones that I love to do is like when we look at the original Star Trek series that happened in the early 70s, and they were visionaries. I mean, they took a little device on their hip that had the wonderful, discovery of Velcro attached. And they would take that off and they would flip it open and they would talk to the ship in space. Now, okay, back in the 70s, you say, oh, yeah, I'm going to build a technology and we can talk to ships in space. And most people would be like, well, what are you talking about? We don't have anything like that. Oh, well, in 30 years, it will be here.
Yeah, yeah, it hasn't been invented yet. Give us a chance, we'll get it.
But see, right now, almost everyone has one of these little things on their sides. And they open them up, and it sends signals into space. And if you have a good friend over at JPL, you call JPL and you say, hey, can you patch me up to the space station or the guys in the shuttlecraft? And guess what? You're talking to people in space. And we're doing this now.
That's why I like my Motorola V3. I've never gotten rid of it because it flips open like a communicator. I like it.
Yeah, I know. I love that technology. But when we understand that, and where it started, it starts out with an idea. Just like you with the beryllium, modems. It's there. It's in our consciousness already. Are we actually inventing it? This is an interesting thing, when we start going into the rabbit hole. Are we really inventing anything? Mm-hmm. Just like you said, when we created the gateway, was it really an accident? And how many things that we can look that were considered accidents that were discoveries, great discoveries?
Great discoveries, one of which was acrylic. How about that? Discovered by accident.
Galvanized tires, to keep the rubber soft.
That's
on
vulcanized.
Tires.
Vulcanized.
Yeah. Vulcanized, I'm sorry, thank you. Yeah, but when we realized that was an accident.
Vulcan.
Yeah, exactly. But all we can keep going on that list, that things that were accidentally discovered.
X Squared Radio, accidentally discovered. We will be back in about 4 minutes. Let's call it 7 minutes. Don't go away. We'll be right back with more John Riley, ZeroPointResearch.com. Don't go away. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Western Idaho. The temperature's dropped slightly. It's now only 149 degrees outside. Not a cloud in the sky. Been reading a book lately called Son of God and small g, capital O, D by Gregory Sams. And he's got some interesting comments in there. And one of the things I wanted to lay on you was usually we give consideration only to our interactions with other human beings and too frequently ignore even this when in the pursuit of material success as defined by personal wealth and influence. We forget or fail to realize that the only true measure of success, our level of happiness and inner peace, is substantially affected by the quality of our interactions with all the others that share our world. The process of rediscovery is supported by sensitive new technologies, enabling us to detect and influence delicate vibrational fields and currents that were once undetectable. Remember, people, intelligence from the bottom up. It's a system in which everything, from a molecule of water to a neuron in our brain to sun itself, is a part of the bottom that is subtly steering a greater whole. My guest tonight is John Riley, his website, zeropointresearch.com. Welcome back to the program, John.
Nice to be here.
So in our first hour, by the way, Earth Explorers, this is a three-hour program, so if you're not getting all 3 hours, make sure to get a hold of us at xsquaredradio.com. We'll get with that affiliate and make sure you get all three. We are a proud member of the BBS Radio Network. And if you're listening to us on the Conscious Media Network on a rebroadcast, we welcome you as well. We are live between 5 and 8 Pacific at BBS Radio. Our phone numbers, if you want to call in and comment or contribute, toll-free U.S. and Canada, 888-228-4494. And anywhere else, on planet, off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us, 530-776-5154. There are a few things that are really important coming up. July 4th weekend at James Gilliland's Ranch in Trout Lake, Washington, is the Earth Transformation Conference. If you are in the neighborhood, then you have no excuse. You have to be there. If you are not in the neighborhood, there are 4 ways to get there. You can fly to Seattle and drive, or you can catch a ride with others for a couple of hours to get there, or you can fly to Portland and get there. You can take a bus, or you can walk. We don't care how you get there, but we want you to participate because Generation 2 of one of the greatest human consciousness experiments in the history of the world is going to take place there. To find out how to get there and how much it costs, it's not much. Go to eceti.org, eceti.org, and get registered. Prepaying is the best way, or you can show up at the door. Either way, I promise you will not be disappointed. Not just because I'm going to be there as a speaker, but because the best speakers on the planet come there. The high vibration, and also, the best of all, maybe the highest possibility of seeing a UFO of your own. You know how often satellites come over? Well, you can look it up at heavensabove.com. That's heavens-above.com. Put in your location, and you can find out when the space station is coming over. By the way, at 3:40 in the morning, 2 mornings ago, it came over at a minus 3.4. It was so bright you could see your shadow on the ground. It is an amazing sight to see if you haven't seen it go over. It's going to be coming over every single morning until the 6th of July. If you're in the Northern Hemisphere here in the U.S., the time for awakening is getting short. You have felt the desire to know more, but you keep getting bombarded by that doom and gloom conspiracy theory-ridden darkness that has been permeating the genre for 2 decades. Well, you won't get that at the Earth Transformation Conference. Always positive, just like right here at X Squared Radio. Okay, John, this hour we're going to delve into this, not only the human paradigm shift, but how this technology seems to tie into triggering that and making it happen. So let's talk about what level is the technology at now, and what do you hope to see on the 4th, 5th, and the 3rd, 4th, and 5th of July up there at Trout Lake?
Well, let's see. I am bringing a few of the technologies out there, and I know one of the ones that you experienced when you were here with me last was the Trinity technology, and how that works with sacred geometry, and also how that works with the human element. You know, and it's we're the third geometrical structure within the energetic field, and what we realize is that when we're literally creating, breaching that zero point state, and when that happens within the human aspect of us, we start realizing something pretty amazing within ourselves. And this is something that I'm really working to bring forward on this weekend, you know, with the group consciousness, and to see what the collective does within this energy. So I remember just watching, you know, just incredible transformations with people there last year, and people, you know, because James is very good about bringing people to the awareness about the land and what the Native American Indian elders always called that place. And I think they called it like a gateway to heaven. And when we talk about the word alchemy and also paradigms in regards to consciousness, is that when we use certain words or phrases or how they're deciphered from the ancients or the elders, and you know how we whisper in one person's ear and then we tell them to do that, and then 10 people later later it's a whole different story. So we got to get back to the origin, to the original meanings, and this is part of the research. So bringing these tools together is kind of the key.
I think we've definitely gotten a different story. I don't know who whispered in Moses' ear. But whoever wrote the first books of the Bible thought they knew what Moses heard. And that has been told to another. And by the time it got to English, it wasn't anything like what the original message was. Oh, by the way, Earth Explorers, I forgot to tell you, in our last hour, Alfred Lambermont Weber is coming on for unprecedented update on the L Cross Moon mission. So you don't want to miss that. Third hour, Alfred Lambermont Weber. Okay. Sorry, John, had to get that in there. Forgot to make that mention at the break. So when you're talking about getting back to source, I find this amazingly fascinating, because that word has even made its way into, let's call it, the dogmatic world, the Christian world. Let's get back to source. Let's get back to God. The whole notion, and I got to say, I've interviewed people who I thought were, you know, good old Southern Baptist, you know, steeped in, dyed in the wool, you know, Baptists. And I've mentioned the fact that, you know, perhaps there's a possibility that that they are source, right? That you actually are, if not part of God, certainly the ability to be God. And they didn't flinch at all. This consciousness, this message is being downloaded into everyone, but not everyone knows what to make of it. So when you're talking about source, are you talking about really getting back to source?
Well, I think that when we look at our journey that we've all signed up to experience this time on the planet, and we look at the uniqueness of what's happening, and I know you and I can get started, because a lot of people talk about the Earth prophecies, you know, the messages that were left here by civilizations before us. And only, you know, when we see the writings on the wall, you know, a lot of people in their arrogance say, well, how come they didn't tell us more? They go, well, this is all that was left. You know, and, you know, what they built these strong enough to last many thousands of years. You know, when we realize the messages, you know, and now it's up to us to consciously choose what to do with this. You know, but when we look at that, now you and I, we do this all the time because we leave the planet. And what I mean by that is that literally we look at the satellites, we look at the telescopes that are out in space, and we're listening to what they're reporting back. And all these instruments that we have floating around our own solar system that are measuring, you know, temperatures on other planets in our solar system, that are noticing pole shifts on other planets on our solar system, this takes us out of our own paradigm of thinking, and it brings us out further in realization that something greater than ourselves is happening.
Well, and we've you know, broached that question here before, that, you know, these great edifices down in the Yucatan and in Egypt and in China and in Malaysia were built at immense cost of gross national product, so it seems. It seems it's the only thing left of those civilizations. And it would seem that they were left precisely for our day. Now, we don't do much in our society for the next generation, let alone something 1,000 years away. I mean, we've spent our grandchildren's inheritances in this country and are doing so around the world every day. We don't give a hoot about two generations away. So why would these civilizations build something so carefully and almost like cartoons so that we would understand what it was they were trying to say today? And the only thing that I can think of when I apply Occam's razor to this and I cut away all the parts that don't make sense, the only thing left is it was us. We were the ones that built those edifices. And we died and were born and we died and were born, and we knew that we would be alive and we would be here at this time on the earth, and we would need that information. And we're trying to remember how to crack it open. Do you think that's what the technology is going to help us do?
Well, when we look at our journey of constantly setting goals and achieving or reaching the apex, it's really amazing what the human species always does, is that it sets a goal. It has a mission, and then what we do is we align ourselves to that goal. And then we have a choice, is to achieve that goal or to, you know, to step away and say, well, I'm not able to achieve this. Now, when we look at this, you know, once we achieve that goal, guess what happens? We relish in it. And we relish in it for what is considered a very short period of time. Because what do we do as a human species? We set a new goal. And we move to the next level. And guess what? What do we find out? After we hit the level that was originally almost unachievable, because the consciousness, the human element, says it's not possible. And then what happens? There's this 3-day phenomenon that happens in almost everything, is that as soon as we hit it or we break what said was impossible, we made it possible, 3 days later there's a human consciousness shift and everyone's going to the next level. Because once it's broken, and we can use the speed of sound as a reference, because they said for years that's not possible to break. And once we did it, what happened? Human consciousness. The information went around the world, sent the signal. And at that point in time, if you were in the old paradigm and you said, no, they can't break the speed of sound, that's not true. Everyone would look at you very oddly, right? But 3 days before that, you were in alliance with everyone else.
Sure. And
so
then now say, oh, that's how it's done.
Right. So this is what we're talking about, the new paradigms in consciousness, in our thinking, is that we have to realize what happens when human consciousness gets such a profound realization or an announcement, however it comes. If it comes from, you know, the internet, it comes from picking up the paper in the morning. These are channels of communication, the network that is around the world. and it happens, within hours. Everyone knows about it. And we can look at that, when we, I know I'm, it might seem like I'm moving off topic, but it's all relative. When we look at mass consciousness awakenings or shifts in human consciousness, and we saw this big when Michael Jackson died, and how that was literally a global event, and it went viral. Everyone literally on this planet knew within hours. Whether you were listening to the news on the radio, whether you were in front of your computer, on Facebook or Twitter, or you're watching, your local news. Mass consciousness shift within moments, and everyone was focusing on his legacy.
It's true. I watched Thriller yesterday.
Yes. I had an incredible event today. It was just absolutely beautiful, and I couldn't have designed this any better, in my 3D reality. Is that when he passed, the first song that came into me was literally the most profound song I think I've ever heard, and that was Man in the Mirror. And a lot of people were doing Thriller and they were doing other things. I said, how come no one's posted Man in the Mirror? Because it's like literally a profound song where he's like talking about making the change for once in his life, and to be the change, and to look at the man in the mirror and to ask him to change his ways.
Right.
So, and what was amazing is I went to Agape, which is Reverend Michael Beckwith's, spiritual center here in Culver City. And I had no idea, but the writer of that song was there as a special guest, and she sung song. Yes. And literally, as soon as they announced that, I saw very clearly that her and I were going to have an amazing conversation today. And there was thousands of people in there. It was about 1,500 people. It was full. And at the end, they mentioned her name. I said, oh, yes, it's time for me to go and to find her. And I literally found her, and I walked up to her, and she had her CDs. I got her CDs. She signed them for me. And I looked at her, and I said, I have to let you know that this was the most profound song. When this came out, it woke me up because I heard the lyrics, and they never left me. And she literally welled up in tears as much as I did. And the people that were listening to the story were so moved by it because it came from such an amazing space within me. And I got to acknowledge her because she wrote the song for him. And it was literally the final song on the Bad album. And it set such an incredible message about making the changes within ourselves. And now human consciousness is when we can hear these lyrics. It's amazing what happened now, how Michael Jackson chose to leave the planet at this point in time and his effect. He even said, to some spiritual people that he was going to leave like Elvis did. So it's getting pretty interesting when we look at it from the whole aspect.
Well, yeah, when you step back and you look at the whole condition of the planet, you look at the whole condition of human consciousness right now, the planet is moving into a region of space that is bathing the solar system with a new energy. It's a new vibration, a new set of photons that humanity has not been exposed to in perhaps 25,000 years. It is said that these frequencies are turning switches on in the human DNA. Now, we don't really know what to do with it. No, we're not going to sprout wings, I don't think, and start flying around. But our ability to pick up on these more subtle energies, these energies that are just beyond the measurement of our regular, very sensitive instruments, are beginning to turn on the perception. That's what word I was looking for. The perception of the human biological transducer. I was talking, I've mentioned before, with Fred Robb, who runs, he's the physicist that runs the high frequency, the LIGO, Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory up in Hanford, Washington, which is listening for black holes. And they have successfully measured several coalescing neutron stars with it. He made the statement while I was up there meeting with him that we see photons, particles, blinking into our dimension from another dimension. That's what he said. So, 5 years ago, there's no way a leading physicist would have said that in public. No way. So, yes, it is opening up. So, now, that being said, you know, we're a little handicapped because we have de-evolved since the days of the shaman. We don't rely on the same tools, mental or physical, that we had, say, 25,000 years ago, because we have the crutch of technology. Well, maybe, and one of the reasons why I wanted to get John Riley on tonight was not just to discuss the experiment we're going to do next week, but also to discuss the possibility that maybe technology will help us regain or amplify or facilitate that ability to pick up on the message that we left for ourselves the last time we were here. So, at least I can tell you that prior to meeting John 3 years ago, for me, I was just, you know, like every other engineer, I was a jumble of formulas and processes and methods and methodologies and philosophies that were steeped in me by 2.5 decades of success building manufacturing facilities. I was not awake. I had never had an experience like I had at James Gilliland's in 2006, never before, that I could remember in my life. And when that ability turned back on, it was not very long that I was led to John, and the rest is technology history. Look at the companies that have sprung out of the mind of Joseph LaStella and are now operating on the planet.
Oh, I know. This is beautiful. Again, like when we're realizing the paradigm shifts, and it's all based on paradigms. That's the reason why. Because Joe, I'm glad you mentioned his name, is that I had a DVD company at one particular point, and he handed me this project. And he says, can you convert this to DVD for me? And so I said, yeah, sure. And I was going to hand it to one of my employees, and all of a sudden I decided to read it, listen to it. It was on VHS, and it was about paradigms. And from that moment, I had my own realization of what paradigms were, and I knew them all the time, but I wasn't conscious of them. And almost everyone on the planet realizes that there are paradigms in all aspects, but we have to come into realization of what they are. And then we have the conscious ability to change them, not remove them, because it becomes very uncomfortable if we drastically shift the paradigm too fast. It becomes a very rough ride.
Well, our race has a tendency to treat paradigms a little like gravity. You know, we say, well, gravity, I mean, what are you going to do about that? You can't do anything about it. I mean, I weigh what I weigh, and gravity is a paradigm, right? But there are things that are, the perception is that it's just as immovable as gravity, but it's not. And that's what's splitting open right now.
Yes, I think I get what you mean on that one. Yeah, I had to go deep in myself on that one. But when we understand what we call gravity, you know, and now of course that's been perceived in many different ways, you know, and then when Einstein, you know, talked about curved space and how mass is affected by, you know, curved space and how it distorts this field of energy. And so now we're getting to this point, which is really amazing, is that when we discovered the atom. You know, we got the abilities. We created electron microscopes. We were able to probe into this incredible universe of the microbe, you know, and just go into this other realization. But then, as you said it, you know, when we talk about source energy, we've been looking at something and we've been drawing them and we've been teaching people, you know, for the longest time. When you even show an atom and you show the nucleus and how these are orbitally arranged molecules that are in motion. And once in a while, you know, the teacher is teaching what he was taught to others, and only that. And I think the educational system is very strict about that. Only teach what you were taught in the educational system. So now all of a sudden a kid will put his hands up, and he'll go, well, those are orbiting around, but what force is allowing them to orbit around? And then the teacher has no choice but to say, well, it's a force that we're not familiar with. We don't have a name for it. So now quantum physics is looking at that invisible force, because we couldn't see it with the sensitive technology that we created, these microscopes, these electron microscopes and beyond that. But now we have no choice because we've accepted what we didn't know before. But now we're looking further. And now we're focusing on that invisible force that's allowing this to happen, that keeps these molecules bonded, you know, that keeps these nucleuses arranged and perfectly arranged. And then we have to come out and realize that it's happening everywhere.
Or take it one step further, and let's talk about the neutron and the proton and the electron
right.
itself. These are not identical. You know, protons and neutrons and electrons are not identical. There's a statistical range of weights, which means there's a statistical range of wave energy that's inside each one of those subatomic particles.
Right.
And, you know, I think it's an infinite range, but, I mean, infinite number of increments inside that range, but a lot of people don't realize this, but not all protons are the same weight. They just are not. A hydrogen proton weighs a lot more than an iron proton. And, in fact, that weight loss is what makes Einstein's formula work. E is equal to mc squared. That little bit of weight loss between a hydrogen proton and a helium proton is what energizes that formula and makes the release of energy. That's where the energy comes from, is the mass loss of the proton itself. Now, I know the average science student doesn't know that, and certainly people that don't know anything about science don't know that, but this is what's shifting the paradigm, is that matter really is just energy. Yes, you've heard lots of others from Oprah Winfrey on down say that, but to really understand that what we're talking about is a universe made of waves, and only a very small portion of it, about 6% of it, has collapsed into particles. The rest of it is still in wave energy, and we're in touch with it. We just have to remember how.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you. Well, it is. You know, when we talk about it, it's all about remembering. You know, because one of the amazing things is that we talk about is that if you take scientists that were kind of battling to or trying to discover something, and then all of a sudden it becomes a discovery, one scientist brings it forward, and he has a conference to prove it to others. And it's a three-day event. And when the other scientists go to hear this guy speak, and on his theories are also the proof, they are in disbelief until it's proven to them. And so they're going to this conference. Before they get there, they're in one paradigm of thinking. And then this amazing three-day event happens. And on the third day, what happens to all the other scientists after they see the proof? It becomes accepted. And guess what? They all leave in a whole different paradigm of thinking. You know, they might have had 10, 15, 20 years of research. And then it's shown to them. And guess what? They don't go home and retire. They go to the next level.
Well, I hope so. I mean, lately it has seemed like when these scientific papers come out that say faster than light travel is possible, or that travel between dimensions is possible, or that evidence that there's energy moving into our dimension from another dimension is possible.
Right. And what are they? And what is happening there?
Well,
this is perfect because what was happening before, 50 years ago, they were saying that these are impossibilities.
Well, that's
now
true.
We have recorded history now to show that we've changed that way of thinking. Is that what people, you know, we see it enough. We, you know, they say, well, you know, past the speed of sound is impossible. You know, going past a certain depth under the ocean is impossible. All these things, but then we hear it enough. And if we're conscious enough, we're going to realize, well, that's just a goal. If someone says it's impossible, some person is going to step up and say, oh, I can beat that. I can change that. And guess what? We do it.
Well, yeah, somebody looked at the way we were traveling through the air by beating it into submission with a propeller and said, you can't go faster than sound if all you can do is beat up air with a propeller.
Right.
You've got to compress it. And then you got to add the fuel to the chamber and kick it out the back so that you can reach these higher speeds. And somebody said, oh, wow, that's a really cool idea. Let's try that. Well, all we got to do now is figure out how to gather up gravity and stuff it in a chamber and amplify it and shoot it out the back, and we've exceeded the speed of light. Oh, yeah, all we got to do is figure out a way to do that. Well, what I've seen and noticed, at least in the professional world and maybe even in the blogging world, is that some of these scientists are not leaving these presentations ready to go to the next paradigm. They're leaving without their belts and their pants down around their ankles because the very thing that they held up their pants with has just been disproven. And they're embarrassed. Their whole careers are on the line here, and they're not ready to jump to the next level. But here's the exciting thing, John. What I see in the youth of America is I see the ability to understand that which is not three-dimensional in this youth. And they're going to do it. They're going to figure out how to break that barrier.
Oh, absolutely. Well, we're breaking them. But again, it's like, when we talk about that 7 to 10 year shift and how there is the consortiums or the think tanks, you know, that implement the first level and then move to the next. And then within a 7 to 10 year aspect, we have a conscious or a technological paradigm shift. It's the same thing with our consciousness. We've been awaking up for quite a while, but now when we look back, you know, just 7 years ago, you know, when we look at our way of thinking, just like you said before you even went to SETI, that you were asleep. You know, but what have you done? You've constantly expanded yourself in this paradigm of thinking. So we could all do that if we're all on this journey. If we open ourselves up into our own realizations and look back, all our lives have constantly shifted in amazing ways. What are we going to do by 2012? We're going to do the same thing. We're going to be expanding into higher levels of consciousness.
Well, maybe the planet is expanding to a higher level of consciousness, too. And if we're
Absolutely.
Not on the train, we're going to be left at the station.
We're all connected. It's all a grand connection. You know, you said it best. When we look, you know, what you're as curious as I am when we look at this century solar minimum that is happening. And what do we have, 24 or 25 day solar cycles this year? You know, it's very low, you know, when we look at that. And you know, what's not told, you know, to the general public is when the sun goes into meditation like that or it becomes idle, there is an effect. There's a butterfly effect. Now, the sun reduces its energy, its bursts, and what happens is the heliosphere around our solar system starts to diminish. And all of a sudden, what are they reporting? NASA's saying that there's gamma rays coming from undeterminable origins hitting our planet. And what when we look at the dots and we connect gamma rays to DNA, those are known as evolutionary events when gamma rays hit the human species. Now let's take the next step and look how close to 2012 we are when all this is happening. This is where it gets interesting, and I really encourage people to get outside their own box, and step outside of their own eyes and become the second, you know, a third-person perspective and see it. You know, pull yourself out as far as you can and realize that it's not just happening in your home and worrying about the bills. All this stuff is happening around us, and it's happening out in the solar system. It's happening in the solar system, but it's happening in the universe. And you say it all. You say it all the time. What we do now, you know, affects the universe. So, you know, do it wisely, think consciously. You know, make those changes. You know, but exciting.
Well, but whether we're asleep or whether we're awake, and unfortunately for Earth, there are a lot of beings out there, conscious as they are, that are not conscious, they're conscious. They don't realize how they're affecting the universe. If you don't believe me, go to the frozen food section of your grocery store and observe, and you will see unconscious beings affecting the universe. And if you don't believe that your thoughts, your actual thoughts and intentions affect the universe, if you're in the shoe department at Walmart, head for the checkout counter. I guarantee you there'll be a line there. But if you don't want the line, what you have to do is walk by the line and mentally put out the thought that you are going to check out the navel oranges. And at the last second, change your mind and there won't be a line and you can check out. Try it. It's a good experiment. It works.
That's a good experiment.
I actually approached the checkout line one time and I was having an impulse. And I eyed the Snickers bar, and in my mind, I was by myself, in my mind, I imagined picking that Snickers bar up and putting it on the conveyor and tasting it as I was walking toward my truck. But I didn't get it. I just put the batteries up there. But when she rang it up, the number wasn't correct, and I said, "That much just for batteries?" And she said, "Well, you did want the Snickers bar, didn't you?" I said, "Yeah, but I didn't put it up on the counter." She rang up the Snickers bar. I had implanted it in her mind as I was walking up there and never picked it up. She actually saw the Snickers bar and rang it up, and it wasn't there. That's how your thoughts can get into other people's minds.
Well, that's excellent you say that, and if you don't mind me bringing... You know, the way that you stated it is when you said, get into other people's minds. Now, I like to kind of expand on that because you're actually not invading a person's mind.
That's true.
You know, or getting into it. What we're realizing in our own technology and our own awareness is that we are these grand transmitters. And we're constantly transmitting signals and receiving on a huge scale. And some people walk with a 3-foot energy field. Some people have the ability to send it out endlessly. You know, this is all part of the path. Now, when you're walking in this open consciousness in the moment, you're realizing that time is the illusion, the perfect illusion, and everything is already, and you're getting these confirmations of your path. And when these little things happen of projection, you know you're going to have a Snickers bar. And all of a sudden, this communication happens. You know, whether there's a conscious or a subconscious realization until the moment is like, wow, this is a Snickers bar. You could just smile, you know, knowing that your path is this of amazement and confirmation, and that you're getting an incredible gift, realizing what you're expanding into. And at that moment, did you not think that you affected the cashier?
Well, actually, what I realized is the cashier knew her job so well, and there was, of course, no line, and she was bored, and she let her mind wander, and she opened up to just anything that popped into her mind. And what popped into her mind was my Snickers bar, because that's what I was projecting.
Ooh, absolutely. And that, what did that do? That changed her day, that changed her paradigm at the same time. Because a very unusual event happened. Unless she does it all the time, or you find out she's psychic because she does it.
You know, or that
event, cool. Yeah, it changed your paradigm.
I was work today. Oh, it was fine. Yes, I rang up another Snickers bar. I have no idea why that keeps happening. That's
so
funny.
Great because it keeps us thinking. It keeps us asking questions. You know,
well, you know, it doesn't take much of an observer, especially in the frozen food section. You'll see people who are, you know, vastly truncated from what their real abilities are. They're so locked into, you know, the budget of their life that they haven't figured out that the whole reason they chose to come here, the whole reason they designed the life that they have here on this planet in agreement with all other beings and all other inanimate objects here, was not to have no experience in the frozen food section, but to have a grand experience and to become something amazing and accomplish amazing things. They just forgot. And maybe that's what we're trying to do. And hopefully in the experiment that we run at James Gilliland's next week, we're able to turn that on in people so that they realize, hey, when I leave this conference, I'm different.
Well, absolutely. Well, one of the wonderful things about this is that when we realize, you know, again, when we pull ourselves out of the three-dimensional aspects of what we are, we realize that everyone that chose to come to that event, that chooses to partake in the gatherings, has already chosen to shift their paradigm of conscious thinking. And something called them to that, to this, whether it was because they follow you, you know, they follow the other speakers. Something is calling them there. And then we can look at this one event as something that can be life-changing or paradigm-changing, or we can realize that that's kind of the orchestration of our lives in general. And when we look at everyone's journey, when we talk about waking them up, you know, we do this in this paradigm. I'm really glad that's what we're talking about, because if 6.5 billion people wake up instantaneously, that could be a very interesting time on this planet.
It'd be a good time to have a consciousness surfboard, because that would be a wave.
Well, exactly, but it would be a wave, but then if everyone's woken up and realizing the structures that are in place, you know, the old paradigm frequencies that are in place, and they notice it right at that moment, 6.5 billion people, we'd cause a very interesting event to happen on this planet. You know, that's like freeing 6.5 billion minds at once, pulling them out of the matrix or pulling them out of the illusion. You know, when we sit in our think tanks, we realize, well, that might not be a good idea. So it has to happen in waves. That's why we talk about the conscious wave that happens. Like just when you expand your consciousness, your wakefulness, your realization, then the people that you connect to, you know, you can, and they expand a little further, and then they, when they connect with other people, expand a little further. So it's all happening. We're all moving into this shift, and almost everyone can rest assured that it's happening. Whether you realize it or not, it's happening, and we're all moving through it. Now, it is a choice. You're absolutely, which level you choose to embrace at that point in time. When we, you know, when we come into a higher level of consciousness, we can see other people in, you know, lower frequencies, keeping themselves held. But the greatest gift is that if we can go on the outside of ourselves, move out of our own eyes, and look and say, you know what, I need to honor this person because 2 years ago I was exactly where they were.
That's right.
Right, and then we can honor the path of everyone on this planet, everyone around us. We will not judge them anymore.
Well, you look at the great leaders that have come to this world, and if you don't think this world is a great place and that it's a grand experiment and it's a beautiful, wonderful place to have a mortal life, I want you to look at the leaders that have come here and had one, not the least of which is Jesus Christ. If you just look at the care and the patience that they had with the asleep and the unaware from the 12 apostles on out, and how it appears hundreds of years, maybe even thousands of years, had to go by before people really understood what he was talking about loving yourself, loving your neighbor, and by doing that, you will love God.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And we call those planting the seeds. You know, again, when we move out of the, you know, when we base things on time, then it can frustrate us.
Sure.
You know, we say, well, why did it take us 1,000 years to get it? Well, that was part of the divine path. Those seeds were planted 1,000 years ago for us to finally hear it. It was part of that conscious evolution. You know, when we realize the temples in Egypt, now you know you have a choice. You know, consciously, you can be unconscious, and you can get on a tour bus, go to Egypt, and have the tour guide, you know, run you into a temple and say, okay, take pictures, and then run you into the next. Or you can choose a conscious tour group that will go into these temples and sit and meditate and show what really happened in here and not be in a hurry to get to the next temple before the sun goes down or before it closes. The people that are consciously open and decide to take that conscious journey, they're going to get it. And they're going to walk through and realize, and they're going to honor. They go, oh my God, this was built thousands of years ago. And we have the ability to walk through it now. It was found in the sand, buried. And people found it again and resurrected it again at this time on this planet. And if you realize what an honor that is, open yourself up and you'll get to see the writings on the wall.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Sit in the sand and just sift it through your fingers and imagine hundreds and hundreds of people walking through that sand, all the sounds and the music and the smells of food and the light that was present in that time and the activities that they were doing, not for themselves, but for the future, for the relationship between the earth and the stars, so that it was clearly understood by not just their society, but everyone on earth that would ever live after them.
Yes, absolutely. Beautiful. Thank you. It's like I said, it's really amazing when we come to that realization. And people, you know, when they look at it and they said, oh, well, these people run amok, you know, really messed up. You know, when we look at the divine plan, the perfect organization of the universe, now we look at it, and I want to hold on to this, I don't want to lose it. When we look at situations that happen and we look at the critical mass, even like the old prophets, going back to Jesus of Nazareth, Krishna, Buddha, they talked on such an enlightened level about cleaning up your house. Now, when we understand that, when someone says clean up your house or clean up the mess within you, clear karma or whatever it is, when that's first told to us in our lives, we have no idea what they mean by that. You'll go home and you'll clean up your bedroom, living room, bathroom, and then, okay, it's done. And then the enlightened one will look at you and go, no, you haven't cleaned your house. It's still a mess. Like, what are you talking about? Oh, you, your temple. Your house, your home that you reside in, not the materialistic home, you know, the three-dimensional, and we're talking about the human vessel. Now, if we're not getting that within ourselves, guess what? We have power mongers. We have, you know, people of world order that come to the surface that hold people and set standards and laws in place, or governments. And guess what? When the energy changes consciously on the planet, they are revealed. And we can see that they ran amok. And this is like, and what we have to do, might be the hardest thing for people to realize, is to honor that path. Because of what they did, and they brought it to the critical mass, it allowed us to awaken and realize we need to change this. And we cannot let this happen again. And it causes us to clean up our houses.
That's exactly right. This temple, this biological transducer that houses the immortal part of us, is only a lens by which we experience or look into this world in which we live, we call a mortal life. Sure, the transducer only lasts 100 or so years, and it does dent, and it scratches, and it breaks, and it gets burned, and all of that, and that's part of the experience, too. But it is not the purpose of life to get to the end with the most toys. It is more a purpose of figuring out, or pulling forward, or for that matter, backward from the future, all of those capabilities that you can bring to the table. The skills that you've learned, the lessons that you've learned when you were the warrior and you were the temple princess and you were the slave and you were the soldier and you were the fisherman and you were the carpenter and you were the victim and you were the oppressor. All of those lessons that you learned come to bear in this mortal life. And if we are able to flip the switch, either by the planet being in a certain peculiar place in the universe, or by applying advanced technology. It's worth the experiment. You should try it. And I think you should make your way up to Trout Lake this weekend, no matter what, and see if you can participate.
Yeah, well, we always promise that it'll be an event not soon forgotten. And that's kind of the aspect of our journey, is kind of, because it's really amazing, is that we can have profound things happen in our lives. I mean, what we literally call miracle events that happen in our lives. And then again, it's the same thing going back to this 3-day phenomenon. this three-day event or three cycles of the sun, is that it almost, when we wake up the next day, you know, we remember the miracle amazingly. But then the next day after that, it becomes less of us to hold on to.
Uh-huh.
And then 3 days after, it's even harder. And after 4 days, it's almost forgetful. Unless it's an awakening moment that happens. And what I mean by that is that it changes our consciousness. It breaks us free of the illusions and the old paradigms. And when that happens, you learn one of the greatest things within ourselves, and that is to live in the moment. And that is just, you know, the past is already gone. It doesn't exist anymore. The future doesn't exist anymore. We, as humans, have the ability to to project ourselves anywhere we want. It's a choice. And this is what's amazing. But when we're in the moment, and that might, you know, at first, it might be a little hard to understand that, but that's literally right here, right now. No thoughts of the past. No thoughts of the future. Right here. And if we could send that frequency out over the airwaves, people that are consciously understanding this, amazing things happen to us when we become in the moment. And this has been part of my journey. And I saw it in you last time I saw you. You know, you were just flowing. You know, with the ebb, you had no stress. You were wide open. You had the big smile on your face. You know, I was taking you to the hotel. I said, "Do you have a reservation?" Because I wasn't in the moment. And you said, "Oh, it doesn't matter. There'll be a room for me." I said, "Well, you know, a lot of the hotels around LAX." And then because you did that, you reminded me. And I followed you up to the door, you know, and I said, "Well, let me go with you just in case." But that was a wake-up call for me, because I realized you walked up and they said, "Oh, yeah, we have a room for you." And I said, "Okay, goodbye." And then when I got out and I drove off in the car, I said, "You know what? He reminded me." You know, I was caught up in so much stuff, but now Brooks reminded me just to be in that moment.
I remember that. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I won't forget it. And, it was great because I smiled to where I wasn't smiling very much that day because I was letting the weight of the old illusions seep back into me. But then you, with that simple movement and that simple realization, because I was able to pull myself back out, because we always have a choice. And I use an interesting analogy. Now, this might work for a lot of people. It might be a little rough, but it's an incredible realization, is that we're on this path, and this is life in general. This is literally in a nutshell, is that we go through this existence, this life cycle, and we get to a point, which is all part of what we're capable of. We can choose at any time what to be. In regards, we can be happy, we can be sad, and we have to come to that realization, is that we're capable. We set this within our consciousness. But we're at this point of paradigm change that's bringing us into the realization of how we feel and how that works. And this is the higher vibration that's happening. But before, we couldn't realize where it was coming from. Is that we just felt this way, and most people go, "I don't know, I just feel bad. I don't know, I'm not happy with things." And then you ask them, and they just keep going, "I don't know, I don't know." Well, that puts us nowhere. But then when we start asking the questions, we get the answers literally all the time. And those are called the laws of the universe. You know, but we have to ask first. But one of the amazing analogies I like to use is that you're standing before the wise elders, and you've gone through this process, and, you know, that they've put before you, whether it's a high priest, you know, in the mystery schools, and you're at that next level of realization of what life it truly is. And they say, "You're ready for this great gift." And they look at you with a smile on your face, and they say, "Are you ready to receive it?" And they go, "Yes, I am." And they smile even brighter, and they go, "Great, hold your hand out." And you hold your hand out, and they come up with the greatest smile on your face. Everyone's watching, and one person will take your hand, hold it tightly, and then cut it off.
Oh, my goodness.
And they'll throw it across the temple floor, and everyone will stand there and stare at you with this incredible smile on your face. Now, at that point, you're going to look at your arm, realizing your hand's gone. You're going to see the blood gushing. You're going to see, you know, you're going to go through the shock and everything. Now, when I say this to people, everyone's going to perceive that moment differently. Some people already know where I'm going with this. But in that moment, however long it takes, when you complete that journey, you're going to stand there. And all the elders are going to still stand there with a smile on their face. And they're going to look at you and say, do you realize what your gift is? And you're going to go, yeah, I have the ability to grow another hand.
Wow.
Now, once we get there, here's the big one. They're going to look at you. And they're going to say, now, everything that you've journeyed, in that realization of showing you what you are capable of, going back in time, when I ask you, are you ready to receive that gift, would you put your hand out? Now, that needs not to be answered. That's the seed. That's what we have to realize. Would you do it again?
Wow.
Yeah.
Sort of like getting your head shot off in Men in Black. When his head
grows, and then it grows a new one.
Man,
yeah,
that's smart.
Yeah, how many strands of DNA are we functioning on?
A couple. I get the picture.
And how many are they realizing that we have? Like 12, or something like that. You know, again, this is all discoveries. These are all part of the consciousness. We keep probing. We move past one goal. We go to the next, and we realize, you know. But this is happening in paradigms of consciousness all around us. And our last interview, we talked about, you know, where it was impossible to go into space unless you were part of a government organization with incredible fuel and billions of dollars. But one man a few years ago, Rutan, did it himself, part of the Ansari X Prize. And what happened? That paradigm has been broken. Now people are independently are going to space. They're building ships because one person showed that it's capable. And fairly inexpensively. And so they set another goal to go to Mars. Now here's another one that you'll love, is that we look at the neural net. I was looking at Popular Science, and they showed the internet, you know, and how it's wired around the world and how these big distribution stations with mega fiber optic pipes that are going under the sea. And what a great job, if you're looking for it, is to be one of the, you have to have good sea legs, is to be on one of these ships that go and repair the cables in the middle of the ocean, days away from land. And they have this sophisticated technology that sends these robots down, and they grab the broken cable, and they pull them all the way up, back up on the ship. And then they stop, and they repair them in the middle of the ocean, however long it takes. And they get paid really well to do this because it's crucial to get those fiber optic pipes back up.
Right.
Why I bring that up is because fiber optic networks, they travel at the speed of light. And those have been implemented for the last, you know, nearly 6 years, you know, 10 years. Now the world is completely set up with this neural network of data. I mean, just quadrobytes of information constantly moving at the speed of light. Now when we look at technology that's always expanding, we are at the speed of light in communication.
Sure.
What's the next level of paradigm? What's the next goal?
Faster than light.
And guess what? It goes right back to our conversation about that modem, you know, the beryllium modem that you talked about.
Right. Instantaneous.
Exactly. Precognizance. When we look at our computers, they constantly double in speed every 2 years. Can you imagine just in 10 years what our computer speeds are going to be?
I can't wait. I'm still waiting on my laptop, and it has dual processors, and I'm still going, come on, hurry up.
Yeah, exactly. It becomes slow. After 3 days, you get used to it. This is the three solar cycles that I like to bring up all the time. After 3 days, you want the next latest and greatest. You're content, but you want, and then they announce, and it usually irritates most people because they save all that money to buy the fastest computer. 3 months later, there's a new one that's even faster, and it starts all over again.
That's right.
Isn't it amazing?
We are out of time for this hour. My guest is John Riley. His website is zeropointresearch.com. If you want to meet him, you want to see the technology, you want to be part of this amazing human consciousness experiment, be at Trout Lake, Washington, ECETI, that's ECETI.org. Get up there and be part of this experiment. I promise you won't be let down. John, you have an amazing week, and I will see you on the 3rd.
I'm so looking forward to it. Thank you, Bucks.
Me too. All right. Earth Explorers, we'll take a short break, and we will be back with Alfred Lambermont Weber So don't go away. We're going to talk about the L-Cross mission to bomb the moon. Don't go away. We'll be back with more X-Squared Radio after this. Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Western Idaho. The temperature is down to about 135 degrees. Not a cloud in the sky. Lots of things happening in the world. We do want you to know this is a three-hour program. We're coming to you on the BBS Radio Network, and if you're listening to us on a rebroadcast on the Conscious Media Network, welcome to the program. If you want to be engaged live, we are live 5 to 8 p.m. Pacific, and you can reach us anytime during that program. The phone lines are open. Toll-free in the U.S., 888-228-4494. Anywhere else on planet, off planet, if you've got free nights and weekends on that cell phone, you can reach us at 530-776-5154. Last week in the news, we made the announcement that NASA was getting ready to conduct what they are billing as an experiment, where they are literally dropping a 4,000-pound bomb onto the moon just to see what happens. Now, they're going to create a 5-mile-wide deep crater, and what they're going to do is reportedly spectrographically analyze the plumes that come up once they drop this kinetic weapon onto the planet of the moon, and see what it has in it. Does it have water? Does it have hydrazine? Is there H3? What kind of content could be there? On the surface, sounds like a pretty good idea, but when you think about it, it's really an attack on another planet, and I'm not the only one that thinks that way. My guest, Alfred Lambert Weber, has agreed to come on the program. By the way, he's going to be one of the speakers at the Earth Transformation Conference this coming 4th of July in Trout Lake. So if you like what you hear tonight, make sure to make your way up there to Trout Lake, because Alfred is going to be up there talking about much more in-depth of things that are going on around in the exopolitical world. Welcome to the program, Alfred.
Well, thank you, Brooks. I'm very, very happy to be here tonight with you.
Well, you know, we haven't spoken probably since last year, and I regret that, because there's so much going on in the exopolitical world. I get your newsletters all the time. Lots of fantastic stuff going on. But this L-Cross, is that what they call it, the L-Cross mission?
Yes, it's correct.
It's particularly alarming. Can you fill us in on the peculiars?
Yes. Well, as you had stated, NASA launched on June 19th a lunar orbiter, which went into orbit this past Wednesday, and will be in orbit until October 9th, where the plan is then to send the weapon down into the southern pole of the moon, allegedly on a water-seeking and lunar colonization experiment, as you set out. Now, the problem, there are two fundamental problems with this. The first problem is that L-Cross itself appears to be and could well be a violation of space law, which prohibits environmental modification of celestial bodies. And if you look at the Outer Space Treaty, which 125 nations have signed, and 96 nations, including the U.S., have ratified, what that treaty says is that space parties to the treaty, this is Article 3, shall carry on activities in the exploration and use of outer space, including the moon and other celestial bodies, in accordance with international law. Well, then, if we turn to the Moon Treaty, this is a specific treaty with regard to the moon, which a number of major nations, including spacefaring nations like India, and a major diplomatic nation like France, have signed. Now, the U.S. has not signed this. However, it deals directly with the issue here. And what it says is that if there is an environmental modification or anything that will affect the environment of the moon, that it says the exploration use of the moon shall be respecting the environment of the moon, and that no environmental modification of the moon shall take place without prior notice to the Secretary General of the UN. Now, taken together, I think that what NASA has done here, because no one in the public was cognizant of this mission, was to go ahead with an illegal environmental modification of the moon by slamming in a 2-ton kinetic weapon. And in fact, this is the first of two. They're going to have two of these shots on the same location. The first on October 9th. So we're saying, number one, that that's contrary to space law, and on those grounds alone that the bombing, which can be done technically, should be aborted. That is, the lunar orbiter is going to be orbiting the moon until October 9th, taking photos and things, which is fine. But that bombing should not take place because the conditions both of the Outer Space Treaty and of the Moon Treaty have not been met, which is a complete environmental impact statement of whether this is necessary and how the impacts of the moon would be done. And in fact, we believe that the Moon Treaty prohibits this. Now, the second reason why this is of concern is that we have now witnessed statements. The U.S. government has known via at least two of its agencies. One is the National Security Agency, and the second is NASA, that there may be extraterrestrial civilizations based on the moon. And we know that, number one, through one of the major disclosure project witnesses, U.S. Air Force Sergeant Carl Wolf, who in his statement at the May 9th Disclosure Project press conference in 2001 at the National Press Club, stated that in the mid-1960s he was detailed to the NSA, the National Security Agency, for several days, and there was told by an NSA employee who had just witnessed and in fact was in the presence of photographs and documents in which NSA had discovered an extraterrestrial base, quote, on the far side of the moon. Secondly, we have multiple statements and multiple witnesses as to statements that when Apollo 11 landed on the moon, and this was confirmed by Buzz Aldrin himself, who was one of these astronauts, who in a television documentary entitled Apollo 11, The Untold Story, admitted publicly that when they landed on the moon, around the rim, there were two very large unidentified flying objects, that is, spacecraft. Now, whether those were extraterrestrial spacecraft or whether those were human spacecraft, it's been assumed that they were extraterrestrial spacecraft. So the U.S. government has known since the mid-1960s that there are extraterrestrial civilizations on the moon, that the ET civilizations were concerned about our landing there. There are witness statements that all of the Gemini missions and all of the Apollo missions were tailed by large unidentified spacecraft. And to start bombing a planet where there is witness statements, and this is us, the outsiders, seems to me could trigger some form of conflict with whatever civilizations may be on the moon. So those are two issues of why we're asking that the LCROSS mission be aborted. The director of this mission, Pete Warden, with whom I was a co-speaker at the 2004 Space for Progress conference, is held in the U.S. Capitol, the largest room in the U.S. Capitol, the second largest room in the U.S. Capitol, has put out a report that the issues that we are raising are, quote, rubbish.
Really?
We believe that is, at the very least, an arrogant statement by a government administrator who does not want to acknowledge that, in fact, he has launched an illegal mission if the bomb is at the moon and does not and is hostile toward the issue of the extraterrestrial civilizations that is maintaining the NASA cover-up. So we believe now that the issue has been joined, and we're now speaking out and going around and raising these issues, which NASA so far has not acknowledged, and we're urging your listeners to begin to contact NASA and to have them abort the LCROSS mission and not bomb the moon until the requirements of international law, namely the Outer Space Treaty and the Moon Treaty, have been met.
Well, I understand the science behind it. In the 60s, we did pretty much the same thing. We launched a much smaller version, but we wanted to make sure that we could actually land a craft on the moon, and we launched kinetic, not bombs, but just weights down on the moon to see what they would do, because we didn't know if the moon was made of green cheese at that time. But this is a much bigger weapon. It's a much bigger experiment, and it's actually designed to create a crater. It's not designed to test the soil like the small ones that were dropped back in those days. And I equated this to back in the 60s, there was a crazy legislator who thought it was a great idea to use an atom bomb to make a new bay in Alaska. And he calculated that if they would explode the weapon by the time the sea filled it back in and things would level out in 5 years, they'd have a really nice warm water bay in Alaska. And fortunately, saner minds prevailed, and they didn't blow the bomb up there. But at that time, nobody lived in that area of Alaska, and it really wouldn't have bothered humans, although it would have been a terrible wreck on the environment. And I'm with you. I think that there at least needs to be an environmental impact study done. I would like to see real independent photographs of the area to make sure there's no base sitting there underneath it. That being said, if there is a base there, do you think they have the capability to shoot this puppy down out of the sky above the moon?
Oh, well, you know, these are one can imagine all sorts of scenarios. I mean, see, there are actually two separate issues here. One is, without even looking at the extraterrestrial presence, what are we dealing with in terms of international law? And if we look at Article 7 of the Moon Treaty, it says, in exploring and using the moon, states parties shall take measures to prevent the disruption of the existing balance of its environments, whether by introducing adverse changes in that environment, by its harmful contamination through the introduction of extraterrestrial matter, or otherwise. And so, granted, the U.S. has not signed the Moon Treaty, but major space powers like India, who is planning a moon mission, have, and France, and so that the Moon Treaty can be considered in construing the Outer Space Treaty, which the U.S. has signed, in which any actions toward the moon shall be in accordance with international law. Well, we now have a treaty which we believe is prevailing international law in this instance, in which states parties may not go forward with things, with acts like the LCROSS bombing, irrespective of whether or not we bring the extraterrestrial issue into it. If we bring the extraterrestrial issue into it, it's clear that both the Outer Space Treaty states that that the moon and other celestial bodies shall be used by all states party to the treaty exclusively for peaceful purposes. In other words, it says the establishment of military bases, installations and fortifications, the testing of any kind of weapon, and the conduct of military maneuvers on celestial bodies shall be forbidden. So that if this bombing is in fact either a direct attack on the moon and on the extraterrestrial civilizations there, even as kind of a shot across the bow and an attempt to impose some kind of sovereignty on the moon, that is explicitly forbidden by the Outer Space Treaty. And in fact, if we go to the Environmental Modification Treaty, which 75 nations have signed, including the U.S., it says each state party of this convention undertakes not to engage in military or other hostile use of environmental modification techniques, which here involves creating a 5-mile crater. And when it goes in the definitional section in Article 2, it says, as used in this article, environmental modification techniques refers to any technique for changing through deliberate manipulation of natural processes, dynamics, composition, or structure of the Earth, including outer space, so that the Environmental Modification Treaty applies to the moon as well, because it applies to outer space. So if we get into the area that if there's any intention at all in NASA, a covert intention, that there's some military component or intention to this bombing, and that is that it's a false flag operation disguised as a scientific experiment, that is explicitly forbidden.
Sure. One has to think, Alfred, that we have methods of putting little rovers all the way on Mars and operating them. Why can't we just drop a rover down on the moon and operate it by joystick from here and do little, you know, safe digging here and there and discover what needs to be discovered? Why do we have to punch a 5-mile-wide hole in the moon?
Right, and that becomes starts to become very suspicious. And especially since all of these treaties are violated here. And we have a history in the U.S. of engaging in military operations as false flag operations. Well, if at least two of the U.S. agencies, the National Security Agencies and NASA, there's documented evidence and witness evidence that they know since the mid-1960s, they have evidence both through the NASA programs and through a national security photographing of the far side of the moon in the mid-1960s, that there are extraterrestrial civilizations on the moon. There are some rational grounds within which to put on the table that this mission, LCROSS mission, may have more than scientific grounds with it. And even if we don't go there on the scientific grounds, and we say, on the environmental grounds alone, this is a violation of the Outer Space Treaty and of the Moon Treaty. So we're in a situation now where the lunar orbiter is now orbiting the moon. NASA has the capability to abort the mission and not to rain down the kinetic weapon on October 9th. So we have a real case of accountability here and non-transparency when the person in charge of this program says that bringing up these issues are quote end of quote rubbish. There is something here that is not computing. So we are now pressing the case forward, and bringing this to public attention and asking all listeners to really listen up and become concerned, because we believe that this issue, as you stated at the beginning of the program, Brooks, is a threshold issue. That is, as humanity ventures out into space, is NASA going to start bombing planets and taking actions out there that could be very, very dangerous? And
sure.
It's
a precedent that our first exploratory move on any planet, bomb it.
Right. You know, and you raise the point, why don't we have moon rovers? I mean, that's the most logical thing. Now, let's take the case of what we're doing in our next nearest planet, apart from the moon, second nearest celestial body and nearest planet, and that's Mars, where we do have Mars rovers. And we now know, as of the middle of December of 08, that based on photographs of the Mars rovers, Mars rover Spirit, several NASA photographs there appear to have, once you get inside that composite photo, appear to have images of life forms, of actual life living on the surface of Mars, namely humanoids, namely various species of animals. Now, if the U.S. has now, through NASA, this policy of proceeding aggressively against the moon, these are issues which have to be seriously considered even more in the case of Mars, where we have initial data from the Mars rover Spirit, photographic data of living life forms and a very fragile post-collapse ecology on the surface of Mars. So these are very serious public issues which have to be raised and discussed and which cannot be summarily dismissed by offhand comments.
Well, I agree with you, and not just from a political point of view, also from a scientific point of view, because, you know, one of my degrees is in biology, and I can tell you in pursuit of that and in research that I've done after getting that degree, that if there is the presence of water and the least little bit of energy, there will be life. So if we're going to bomb the polar caps of the moon from space, and I would think this thing's going to hit the ground at somewhere around 20,000 miles an hour, it's going to rain death down upon that area. Now, Alfred, do you know if there are any explosives in this weapon, or is this just like a big heavy beer keg that they're going to drop down on the moon? By the way, 2 tons here is not 2 tons there. So this has got to be a pretty good-sized weapon for it to weigh that much. It'd have to weigh a lot more in launching it from here on the Earth if it doesn't have any explosives in it. Do you know that much?
Yes. I believe that the kinetic weapon that they're using is an Atlas rocket.
Oh, my goodness.
They're going to crash in into the crater at 5,600 miles per hour, creating a new crater perhaps as large as 5 miles wide. But the point is that, you know, the last time that the U.S. went into another territory against United Nations treaties, which they had signed, and against the United Nations objections, was in a place called Iraq, at which point it was expected that the U.S. was putting out the line that they would be treated as liberators and that flowers would be strewn in their path. Well, now we have 6 years later, from 2003, we have thousands of U.S. troops dead, billions, if not trillions, spent. We have, the latest report that I heard last week was 1 million U.S. servicemen disabled through depleted uranium weapons. We have 1 million Iraqis dead, and we have 4 million Iraqis displaced and in exile. And we have a culture that has been shredded. And so this policy of bomb first, illegally, is something that, in a terrestrial context, has gotten the U.S. into a lot of trouble. And now it's extending that policy because there is no supervision or consciousness at the top that is willing to examine the U.S.'s treaty obligations that is going forward with this. And without even getting to the extraterrestrial issue, this is a violation of treaty obligations, and it is an illegal modification of the environment of the moon by the Moon Treaty and by the Outer Space Treaty. And to get around to the question which you asked, which is, do you think that there will be, if there are extraterrestrial civilizations on the moon, will this cause a reaction? Well, we don't know. This is a rash, illegal act from an environmental point of view. If it's a military act masquerading as a scientific experiment, then it is illegal under the Outer Space Treaty and illegal under the Environmental Modification Treaty and illegal under the Moon Treaty. And if there are extraterrestrial civilizations on the moon, this is very, very perilous. Now,
yes, it is. Oh, by the way, one of my listeners in Missouri, Alex, says, "Hey, Brooks, I remember that I heard someone, not sure who, that Wernher von Braun said that he was afraid that once, after declaring war on terrorism and winning the next war, our nation would wage would be with ET."
Yes. Now, he said, if I can remember, and that's from a Disclosure Project witness, that it would be a false war against terror. And if we look at the false flag operation of September 11th, which launched the, quote, war on terror, that's exactly what it was. And von Braun is reported to have said, yes, and it will be a false war against the evil ETs. Now, there is some evidence, and again, this is from UFO researcher Gary McKinnon, who is now awaiting a hearing on in the middle of July 15th, I believe. He's in the UK, and the U.S. is attempting to prosecute him for up to 70 or 80 years in jail for allegedly breaking into NASA and U.S. Air Force and U.S. Navy computers, where he ascertained that there were outer space officers. There were certain naval officers that were outer space officers, that is, assigned to ships or to naval vehicles that were not based on Earth. So that one could very easily, this is one of the first objective proofs, aside from other whistleblowers, that we've had, that there is a, quote, black budget, or there may be a black budget space navy, with anti-gravity vehicles that can go to the moon, and perhaps have bases there, can go to other planets. such that there are all sorts of possibilities that could be occurring here. I've had correspondents who are expert in the exopolitics field who don't want their names used, who have emailed me saying that there is some information that this LCROSS mission may be designed to destroy remnants of a space navy base that was there, or a non-used extraterrestrial base that they want to destroy now, that other parties like the European Space Agency, Japan, China, and India are going to the moon. Whether that's credible evidence or not, I don't know, because I haven't seen it. But now we do have some evidence that there is an anti-gravitic space navy, and that there may have been both black budget or shadow government bases on the moon, apart from the extraterrestrial bases that were discovered there by the National Security Agency. So it seems that the moon already has been an object of interest both to extraterrestrial civilizations and possibly to the black budget or shadow government spacecraft from the Earth. So this bombing is now going into potentially a very volatile situation on the moon, and certainly an illegal one. And so this is why we're pressing the case and making this public, because of its potential consequences, its potential negative consequences. We just read today an article at the Examiner by Jeff Peckman, one of our fellow examiners in Denver, and he had been on the ABC affiliate in Denver, ABC TV, promoting and explaining to the public the Denver Extraterrestrial Initiative, which is to have a commission in Denver, which would be approved on the ballot by the Denver voters, which would examine extraterrestrial affairs. Well, apparently one of the NASA solar ambassadors called into the program with a negative comment on it. So here we have now NASA personnel that are reaching out and making extremely negative comments. So it seems to me that where we have the director of the LCROSS mission, Pete Worden, saying that it's rubbish to start raising these issues, where we have a NASA solar ambassador now calling into an ABC television live program on the Denver Extraterrestrial Initiative, we're beginning to have a pattern. Now, just to round that pattern out, when we had the publication of the NASA rover photos and the images in there, which showed life walking on the surface of Mars, which is photographs of humanoids and photographs of animals. And Brooks, we're going to be showing that in a special PowerPoint at the ESETI conference.
Oh, nice.
July 3rd to 6th. So people can get a firsthand view of those images there. And when the images were first published and this story was first published, we had attack pieces from NASA employees. Just this week, the news director of the Hubble telescope has published an attack piece on the images of life on Mars in the Discover Channel, and also a former NASA employee, Phil Plate, has done the same thing. So now, if we have that both on the Mars issue, on the Moon issue, and now on the Extraterrestrial Commission in Denver, where NASA employees or former NASA employees are taking the lead in attacking all of these attempts to uncover a NASA cover-up, it appears to me that we have a pattern here, a pattern of U.S. taxpayer funds being used directly to cover up, not in accordance with the purposes of NASA in the 1958 National Aeronautic and Space Act, which stated that the purpose of NASA is to explore the universe and to report back on its findings. And so these are very, very serious issues that run counter to President Barack Obama's first executive orders when in office, one on transparency in government, and the second one on freedom of information. And so
I don't want you to distract him, because now he's concentrating on alternative energy and electric vehicles, and we're really waiting on that FOA. We really need that federal grant in order to launch this electric car company in Kentucky. So, by the way...
There was a very large grant made just this past week to Tesla Motors.
Well, it wasn't a grant. That was a loan. Oh, and it was actually a federal loan guarantee.
Yeah.
It was just a federal loan guarantee. They still have to go get the loan from a bank.
Right, right. But we don't think that this will distract Barack Obama. I mean, he's shown that he's capable of action on multiple channels, but here we have an agency, that NASA, that appears to be rogue in terms of its missions, and that is developing a very strong pattern of active cover-up, and now in the LCROSS mission has crossed over into illegal activities.
It does seem that way, because the whole design of the MARSIS program, the Opportunity, the Spirit, the Phoenix, it's just a different philosophy of going to Mars. And you know, those little rovers have lasted for years longer than they thought they would, and they've returned a priceless amount of data that has just captured the heart of the entire world. So why in the world would we go to our closest neighbor, a mere 250,000 miles away, and bomb it, when we have the ability to drop nice little benign robots on them that are capable of core drilling down and discovering everything we need to know without actually bombing the moon? Now, you'll remember when Eagle took off from the moon, when it exhausted its fuel supply, it dropped its empty aluminum fuel tank back down toward the moon, where they had just, the astronauts had just placed a series of geophones, because all of the astronauts were trained in geology before they went to the moon. And when that little tiny 350-pound aluminum fuel tank struck the moon rang like a bell for 2 hours on those geophones. That means that if this is the first time we've actually dropped something that weighs 4,000 pounds going 5,600 miles an hour, as you say, into the soil of the moon, this is going to make the moon ring not like a bell, but like a shot. If there's anything on the inside of the moon, it might be disturbed.
Yes, yes, there are all sorts of reports of anomalous events happening on the moon. There was a report in 2005 of an explosion on the moon, so we don't know if that was affiliated with an accident or mining or other industrial activity. And there have been reports of lights on the moon, artificial lights. And so those may be affiliated with extraterrestrial and or other unknown activities or parties on the moon. There is, as you just stated, there are some reports that the moon itself may be a hollow satellite. And that might even be consistent with what you just stated, that the moon has rung as a bell. So these are all of the risks that are associated with this mission. And I just wanted to bring to public attention that here not only do we have an agency that has committed an unlawful act, but when it's been brought to their attention, they have stated that it's rubbish. Now, that is a sort of arrogance which is very, very dangerous. And I believe that we have a duty to continue to bring this to public attention, and that the public should be very concerned, because we don't know how many different ways that this might play. I mean, just looking at the Moon Treaty by itself, which prohibits environmental modifications to the moon, those are for a reason. And if there are other civilizations on the moon, or if there are other activities on the moon, such as we have a large growing body of evidence, we don't know what this is going to touch off. And as your listener who just communicated into the program, this could be a false flag operation, or this could be an event that could trigger a lot of unforeseen consequences, which would be harmful. At the very least, this is an illegal, non-productive, counterproductive, non-scientific, anti-environmental way for the space agency to proceed.
Well, I believe in, I support most of that. I think that there probably is some legitimate scientific data that can be gained from this, but my question is the methodology. We have already developed a very sensible, very low-impact methodology for exploring other worlds. We don't explore other worlds by slamming kinetic weapons into them. And I'm all for moon mining. I'm all for a moon base. I'm all for exploring space using the moon as a launch pad. There's plenty of fuel on the moon. There's plenty of oxygen in the soil of the moon. There's plenty of water in the soil of the moon. It's completely feasible to build something that could function long range on the moon. And we could learn a lot about space by and about our planet by building a permanent base on the moon and shuttling people back and forth. But I am with you 100% in that we've got these established methodologies. We have this legal treaty in place which says we don't environmentally modify willy-nilly other planets. Now, we can mine them, you know, as long as, we're not introducing microbes that will, you know, change it into a green cheese. But we don't start out our exploratory efforts on another planet by bombing it. It just doesn't seem true to form. And in that respect, I agree with you. NASA is acting a little bit like a spoiled child here that wants to show off its new weapon.
Right, so the issue now is accountability, and how to either how to get accountability from NASA. And so that's why we're calling for this mission to be aborted. The lunar orbiter will be orbiting the moon, taking photographs, sending other data back to Earth through October 9th. And we say that that's fine, but that kinetic weapon should not be launched and that the mission should be aborted. And I'm just wondering how we can begin to move this public awareness forward and really get some accountability with NASA at this point.
I really don't know the answer to that. I know they just appointed a new director, and no, it wasn't Richard Hoagland. I don't recall his name, don't know what his philosophies are, but if this mission is in alignment with his exploratory philosophies, I disagree with it. We're not talking about CERN here. We're not shooting gold ions at one another at the speed of light inside a magnetic field to understand the origins of the universe. We're colliding something into our nearest neighbor, for crying out loud. Come on, people, let's wake up a little bit. Alfred is right. You need to write your congressmen, your senators, and say, hey, what the heck is going on here? We got 4 months. We can scrub this mission or figure out a better way to do it. You guys did it wrong this time.
Right. The nomination of former astronaut Charles Bolden as a NASA as a new administrator of NASA is now has now occurred. So I think that people who are concerned about this issue should contact Charles Bolden, and you can go. We've written an article on Examiner.com. You can go to Examiner.com, or you can go to Exopolitics.com, and there'll be a link to our column on the Examiner there. And so far this month, almost 100,000 people have gone to that column, and the bulk of them have read this article. So we're starting to achieve something of a widespread familiarity and awareness with this issue, and with the issue in depth. I mean, the U.S. has prosecuted wars in the past century and in this century, which have been illegal and which have been very destructive. If we go to the Vietnam War, that was passed on the basis of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, and now historical evidence shows that the entire incident was fabricated, and that it was on the basis of false reports from the Turner Joy and the Maddox, two of the U.S. Ships that were in that area that were reported as under attack from North Vietnamese vessels, and that report was entirely false. Within 24 hours of that report, Lyndon Johnson went to the U.S. Congress and got the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which led to the Vietnam War that tore America apart, that led to the deaths of 50,000 U.S. soldiers, that led to the deaths of between 1 and 10 million Southeast Asia, people in Southeast Asia, that led to vast and environmental destruction there through Agent Orange. We've had the second example of the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War, both of which were started. The Afghanistan War was started illegally in 2001 following a false flag operation in which the then sitting president, vice president, and secretary of defense were complicit. In fact, it was a violation of Article 3.3 of the U.S. Constitution, which is treason against the U.S. And likewise, the Iraq War was carried out against actions of the United Nations and was likewise an illegal war, and the consequences have been terrible, both for the U.S. and for the people of the region.
Well, consequences of war are always terrible. However, I do remember walking down the sidewalk, eating cookies and drinking milk, minding my own business, when my airline was knocked out of the sky because somebody flew an airplane into a building and killed all the people that were working on my loan. I do remember that. So I don't know whether it was illegal or whether it wasn't, but somebody attacked us first. And that's not what this program's about anyway,
okay.
So I don't want to talk about it anymore.
Okay, fine. Well, the only point that I'm making is that the L-Cross mission is illegal. It's against the Outer Space Treaty. It's against the Moon Treaty. If there was a hostile intent if there is a hostile intent in the L-Cross mission, either to wipe out bases there or to shake up the people, the various extraterrestrial civilizations on the moon, and for whatever reasons, then that is absolutely forbidden by the Outer Space Treaty, by the Moon Treaty, and by the Environmental Modification Treaty, which also applies to outer space.
Sure. I mean, what happens if we do disturb them and they do come out pouring by the millions and their craft come down here all pissed off? We're going to say, oh, we're sorry, we didn't know. Well, that's why treaties like this are in place. So we don't go stepping on, you know, indigenous peoples, whether they're human or not, on other planets.
Right. So I'm very glad that you did call me, Brooks, and that I was able to bring this information to public light. And hopefully I've been on many radio programs. I'll be on a number of radio programs during the coming week with regard to L-Cross. And these are major broadcasters that are contacting us because they're concerned about the issue.
Exactly.
And see it as an important public issue. So I'm very, very glad that you did call.
And we're glad that you came on the program, Alfred. And I will see you up at James's on the 4th of July. Alfred's website is exopolitics. Is it .com or .org?
Yes, it's exopolitics.com.
All right, exopolitics.com. Thank you so much, Alfred, for coming on short notice. Sure. And only you could have given us the detail of that treaty. I can tell you that. Thank you so much.
Certainly. Thank you.
All right, good night, my friend.
Okay, good night.
Well, there you have it, Earth Explorers. Another priceless episode of X Squared Radio. John Riley and Alfred Lambermont Weber coming to you. Next week, we will be at the eSETI conference and going to try to broadcast live from the site. So maybe not an archive. You may want to hang in there. We'll see you then.
It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening.
Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.